What up, folks? This episode of the Smoking Tire Podcast is brought to you by JB Weld, home of the world's strongest bond. You've heard of JB Weld before. It's like it's like a verb. It's like the strongest thing you can put on your car, your project, whatever. Pros have turned to JB Weld for over 50 years, but why even bother hiring a pro when JB Weld's adhesive products make it so easy to do it yourself? Whether you're talking about a DIY project at home, an automotive repair, plumbing, marine, or more, for projects big and small, at home or in your garage, JB Weld is what's up. In fact, JB Weld products can be used on practically anything: metal, wood, plastics, glass, ceramics, and more. Keep it handy in the toolbox, keep one in the kitchen drawer, and keep one in the back of the car. You never know when you're going to need it. Speaking of the back of the truck, JB Weld just acquired Herculiner, the original DIY truck bed liner. So if you're looking for the world's strongest truck bed liner, Herculiner's got you covered there. You can use it on boats, use it on stairs, and in fact, I am planning to use the Herculiner they sent me on the shop floor here at the garage. I'm going to make a fake carpet out of Herculiner in the lobby, like a pattern. I'll make a pattern with tape and then roll the Herculiner down.
Yeah.
So there'll be like a pattern in bed liner on the floor. It'll be very cool.
You can use it for like a non-stick surface on stairs.
Exactly.
Like
yeah. Non-slip. Go be your strongest self. Use JB Weld, the world's strongest bond. It is available at, are you ready for this, j-bweld.com, Walmart, Amazon, Home Depot, Lowe's, AutoZone, Advance Auto Parts, Napa, O'Reilly, Michaels, and more. JB Weld epoxy products are proudly made in the USA, and it is the world's strongest bond. So check it out at all of those places. We're also brought to you by Policy Genius. Policy Genius is America's leading online insurance marketplace. The mission is to help people get insurance right by making it easy for them to understand their options, compare quotes, and buy a policy all in one place. Policy Genius can help you find home and auto coverage similar to what you have now, but at a much lower price. They save customers an average of $1,250 per year over what they were paying for home and auto insurance. Their team will handle the paperwork to set up your new policy or switch over your current one. Getting started is super easy. Just go to policygenius.com, answer a few quick questions about yourself and your property. Then Policy Genius takes it from there. They compare rates from America's top insurers, from Progressive to Allstate, to find your lowest quotes. The Policy Genius team can look for ways to save you more, including bundling your home and auto policies. If they find a better rate than what you're paying now, they will switch you over for free. Their top-notch service has earned Policy Genius an excellent rating on Trustpilot. So head over to policygenius.com right now to get started, because Policy Genius, when it comes to home insurance, it's nice to get it right. Now, let me talk to you about these Raycon earbuds. I'm supposed to read this ad, but I don't even have to really read it because they sent me the Raycons to use. And the other day, it's them on the left, the little blue joints. I had to drive the red car, the Lamborghini, up to Donnie's in the middle of the desert. The car, the stereo is just not there. Like, it's there, but it's not like the for one reason or another. Earbuds are the way to go in this car. And I like listening to a V12 like anybody else, but on a highway trip, give me some music, give me a podcast, let me get lost in the zone. You know what I mean? So I threw in the Raycons, I charged them up in this nice little kind of egg-shaped, you know, case they come in, plugged them in overnight, fully charged, threw them in my ears, pressed the power button, and there they were on my phone in the Bluetooth menu, clicked to connect, and boom, Raycons going.
They synced super fast.
I then, like, kind of, I was walking around a shop with them in my ears, and I left my phone and I walked away from them, and it was like, bloop, Raycon disconnected. And then when I walked back up to my phone, it was like, bloop, Raycon connected. So it did the thing.
Yeah.
And then I listened to the new episode of The Dollop all the way up to Donnie's. Nice, loud, and clear. And, you know, unlike some other earbuds I've tried where they fall out of my ears, a certain computer and phone manufacturers wireless earbuds, they just don't stay
in
my ears.
They don't work in my ears either. Yeah.
I did a 90-minute car ride out to the desert. no adjustments, zero, just in the ear, and there they set.
Yeah.
They come with a bunch of different size, little rubbery guys that you can interchange to make it fit your ear really well. And honestly, I got crisp, powerful beats. I got clear voices in the podcast. I had a call with my wife, worked nice. They come in different colors. And quick and seamless Bluetooth pairing, a very compact charging case, and they last a long time. You know, I used them on that whole trip, I used them on the whole drive home, and they still had plenty of battery left. Very cool, and I'm using an Apple device, and they integrated with an Apple device quickly, easily, and utterly painlessly. So listen up. Raycon is offering 15% off all of their products for my listeners, and here's what you got to do to get it. Go to buyraycon.com/smoking. There you will get your 15% off the entire Raycon order, and it's such a good deal, you'll want to buy a pair and a spare. 15% off at buyraycon.com/smoking. That's buyraycon.com/smoking. We are also brought to you by my favorite, the most delicious, the most scrumptious, the stickiest of the ickiest, Tradecraft Farms. Whether it's CBD you're looking for, or whether you just want to go for the full bore, high powered brute force THC, Tradecraft Farms has you covered. If you are in one of these civilized places where these things are perfectly legal, then ask for it in your dispensary or visit one of their retail locations throughout the California area. If you are not somewhere where it is so civilized that you can walk into a store and purchase these items on a credit card, give them a follow on Instagram. They got a fun little Instagram going. Great up-close shots of beautiful, sticky, icky. You feel me? They got the solid gold joints. They got the rose petal thing. I mean, it's all crazy down there. They're doing weird, funky science, and the ganja banaka is coming out soon, too. It's ridiculous! Tradecraft Farms is the official cannabis provider of the Smoking Tire podcast, and it still makes me smile every time I get to say that. All right, on this episode of the Smoking Tire podcast, my dad, my old man, is finally here. You know, COVID vaccinations have made travel nice and safe again, and he is in the studio, and we're going to do something that I've never really done, which is basically go through his entire career in one sitting. He has done a lot of fucking crazy shit, as we will see in this 90 minutes of podcasting. It's my father, Roger Farah, on the Smoking Tire podcast.
I'm fine.
Professional broadcaster on this side of the table.
Amateur.
This is what it is. This is the whole gig.
Okay.
It's fun. Gunther works. So, all right. So, hey, everybody. This is my dad. This is Roger. Roger has a 50-year career in high fashion retail. It goes back to the 70s. And, you know, as I grew up, obviously I got to enjoy a lot of the spoils of that hard work and that success. We had a nice home. We had nice things. We traveled to nice places. I didn't see you as much as I wanted to, but that's okay, because you're a great dad, and we have a great relationship as adults. But we never stopped. I always, as you went through jobs and stuff, just sort of took for granted, like that's where you were. And we never really analyzed it in detail, except until very recently, where we've talked about what was going on at work as I've understood it a little better. But I read that profile that the boys were talking about with you and Bernard Arnault, and they summarized your career, and they reminded me that you were CEO of Saks Fifth Avenue at 33 years old.
That's not exactly true. I was the CEO of Riches in Atlanta at 33.
Oh, okay.
They misquoted where I was working. My first 12 years was at Saks Fifth Avenue, but I left to go be the CEO of Riches in Atlanta at 33.
Which is another department store chain.
It's like the Bloomingdale's of Atlanta.
But what always impressed me, and from the very beginning, was your
One of the things I thought, I mean, that you, that really put you in such an advantage over everybody else was your ability to do four-function speed math in your head. Did you always have that? Did you intentionally teach yourself that? Or is that a gift? Because I know all your friends from high school, and you guys were the jocks. You weren't a nerd. Your friends were all 6'3 and played basketball and soccer. And all you, not all, but you, when you talk about high school, you talk about sports, not classes. Yeah. So where did your four-function speed math skill come from?
Well, it was not learned in a book, for sure. I learned functional math very early in my business career, where I was a trainee and then an assistant level to a vice president at Saks Fifth Avenue at the time, and he had me do the budgets and all the analytics for every department in the company. And I was doing math in my head all day long to accelerate how long it took me so I could then spend time on other things. But I was saying to Zach this morning that it got to a point where it was almost like The Beautiful Mind, where Russell Crowe would look at a wall of numbers and certain numbers would turn bright.
Yeah, I mean, I've never seen anybody absorb a spreadsheet or, you know, when I was talking about starting my own businesses and I call you and you calculate interest rates in real time and you calculate payments in real time and you calculate taxes in real time. Yeah. I've never really seen anybody else that can do that.
Well, I learned quickly how to do math in my head and also what numbers were important. So if I looked at a spreadsheet or an annual report or I looked at a presentation somebody was making to me or a quarterly report, I could very quickly, you know, get through 50, 60 pages and find the two numbers that were really important. And on the reverse side, I could also find the one or two mistakes. They instantly sort of pop off the page. And
I remember someone, you told me the story of someone gave you the wrong packet at some meeting. They gave you their packet instead of your packet. And it said, like, don't fuck with Roger. He can do crazy math or something written in it.
Yeah, this guy was doing a presentation. He was an architect. And there was a dozen of us around a table, probably six of his people, six of mine. And he passes out his books for the presentation. And I open mine, and it's full of notes. And I realized he had given me his copy. And I saw the look of panic on his face. And I read in the note, you know, don't play with numbers. Roger's really good with numbers. And I'm watching the blood drain out of his head. And, you know, probably a little mean, but I waited about 10 or 15 seconds. And I said, you know, maybe I think I've got your book here and you may want it back. And he finally started to breathe again.
But I look back and, you know, I went to a good school, high school. I went to a good college. You know, we went to the same University of Pennsylvania, which I'm still certain I didn't deserve to go there. I'm concerned.
Not
that,
true.
I'm certain that there were shenanigans that
Not
got me
true.
Into that fucking school. I was fine once I was there, but, you know, like everybody is, you know, but I could swear there was some shenanigans happening there. But,
totally deserved.
my art portfolio is really good enough. Yeah. No one ever said, you know, by the way, here's a skill that will get you so far ahead in your life, and there should be a class on it or something. Instead, it's like, calculus? What are we doing with that? Why is this not something that is taught?
You know,
it
Matt,
seems so useful.
100% true. If people would learn how to use math in their life, in their business, addition, subtraction, division, just basic concepts. Calculus, which you struggle to get through, everybody struggles to get through, and then never use it again unless you're an engineer or a scientist.
3% of the population uses
calculus. But if you can use math, it's intimidating to people. They are immediately defensive.
Oh my God, you should see this. You should
They're
see
on their heels.
With a car salesman or with, I mean, just with
They're
someone
shocked.
Who thinks they can do numbers because they're in their house, but oh my God, I've seen you steamroll people.
Well, and what happens is people have now gotten used to pulling out a calculator for what's 5% of 100. And, you know, quite frankly, you
17.
Should be able to do that in your head. But I was at a bank meeting with Alexis, your sister, and we were talking to a rep, and he starts pulling out his calculator. I said, are you telling me you can't do 5% of 100 in your head? And all of a sudden, he starts to turn green. And then the next number comes along, and I said, you can't do that in your head? And now he's on his, you know, defensive. So look, business negotiations, you know, can turn on those kind of advantages. So part of it was just natural. Part of it was, you know, learned. I'm not sure I'm as good today as I was in my prime, but it's an effective tool. Now, I don't have your mind on other subjects. You use your memory and your instant recall and your ability to integrate thoughts as a weapon. I'm not as good at that, but I was good at math.
Yeah. I think math makes you more money. I think math is probably the right strategy, and I chose, I don't know, the artist's route or whatever you want to call it.
Can I ask a follow-up to that? So when you, you know, we all took similar math classes in grade school and high school, and we learned percentages and things like that. But when you were taking those classes, did you understand how valuable it would be?
No, he's saying he never took those classes.
I took all the basic math classes, and I went to the Wharton School of Business, which has, you know, a heavy component of...
You majored in econ, right?
I majored in econ. And, you know, you took finance 1 and 2, accounting, you know, courses. You took, you know, all of the basic requirements of business school, which, you know, have math woven through it. But it wasn't until I got out of school and I realized how useful it was and how being able to do it in my head in a conversation and use it effectively to gain an advantage that I began to leverage that into a life skill. And when the kids were little, believe it or not, we used to have fun because we would play checkbook. They were in the back seat, and we would play checkbook in the car with, okay, you have your $10 in your checkbook, and you put 20 in, and then you have to pay a $7, you know, check out. What do you have left? And, you know, and I was trying to teach them how to do it in their head without pencil and paper or, you know, at the time, you know, any kind of electronic device. But it was really when I got into business that that numbers weave their way through almost every, you know, business situation, that I began to realize being able to do it in my head and hold it in my head, or using it and articulating it at a different time.
Mm-hmm. He could do it while talking about some other shit.
Is an advantage.
He can be having a conversation with you and doing an interest rate in his head at the same time, and you won't know he's doing it.
Yeah, Very impressive. It's an advantage. Yeah. And you use whatever skills, talents you have, and you know, you sort of work around what you're not good at, and you try to minimize that as a reality of getting to know yourself and what you can do. And the other thing that I did early on that has served me well is I really understand where I'm trying to go. And then I work back to the present. And so whether it's a business strategy, where do I want to be in 10 years and how do I bring that back to an action plan now? Or where do I want this conversation to go, either an interview or a negotiation, and how do I move my way towards that? And how do I ask somebody questions that the follow-up question they're going to ask me is really the one I want? Mm-hmm. And so when I was running public companies and having to deal with Wall Street and shareholders and analysts, one of the things I did well, and I, you know, Matt has, you know, this ability to do it live on camera first take, I could be managing a conversation like chess, where I'm 2 or 3 steps ahead. And I want to know that question to come at me, and I've got to set it up so they ask me, but I take them on a journey a little bit until I get to the point where they're asking
me
the question.
It's like setting up a pass on the track, like 3 corners ahead.
Right. Yeah. It's like chess.
Yeah, it's crazy.
And so whether you do it with
numbers.
And
I've been watching this shit for 30 years. It's crazy. When I can tell.
When you get home late at night and
he
starts asking questions.
Oh, it didn't. Like, yeah. Oh, it was, listen, I didn't get away with anything. I didn't get away with shit.
Well, when my business friends are watching this, they start playing the Jaws music in their head. Because they can see it coming now after all these years.
I can see it coming, too. I know how it's going to work. But that's actually, when you're talking about, I used to hear kind of little snippets of the real differences between running a big public company and running a private company, and how much of your time had to be spent justifying your own actions to various people. What is the real, you know, takeaway from that, from someone who really would excel at a public company versus would excel at a smaller private company maybe?
Well, having run a variety of public companies and or chaired the boards, I would say a third of my time. Think about this, a third of my time.
And you work hours.
And I worked endless hours, was invested in communicating and selling to either a board of directors or other senior management or to shareholders or prospective shareholders or media, selling your strategy. And what you have to be able to do—
That sounds thankless.
Is, well, it's exhausting because I'd rather spend that time on running the business.
Yeah.
In a private company, maybe you have bankers, maybe you have a partner, but it's a much more limited time investment to explain what you're doing. Here, you have to explain it over and over and over again. And you got to do it in a high level of detail with a shareholder who's an owner or an analyst who maybe you want them to buy your stock. And you have to be able to grade it down to the lowest level employee. How do I distill the strategy for somebody who's only, you know, been in the company a year or two that they can understand it? So you have to scale it up or scale it down. You have to add statistics and anecdotes for one audience that you want to leave out for another audience. And it's a huge amount of time. I would probably spend 300 appointments a year with shareholders, individual, one-on-one, hour, hour and a half sessions.
Does any shareholder have the right to like book an appointment with the CEO?
Or large shareholders expect to see the CEO. Smaller or prospective probably start with the chief financial officer.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, if they say they want to see the CEO, you know, obviously it's my choice, but you know, you try to accommodate it. But I couldn't handle somebody running in my office that say, gee, it's Tuesday at 10 Fidelity's showed up. Can you see them?
Yeah.
But on a program basis, it was a lot of time and energy.
That's crazy. I mean, what is the real, you know, to go from, okay, I work at a company, to now maybe I'm going to start or run a company that's going to have 5 employees, to now, you know, 500, to now 50,000. You know, what is the real differences between that micro and that macro level management skills?
You know, when you're starting or you're an entrepreneur, you have a small headcount, you have to personally do a lot more. You have to roll up your sleeves, whether it's make the coffee in the morning or actually execute on all the strategies and tactics. The higher you get, whether you're a vice president, a senior vice president, CEO, whether you're running a domestic company or a global company, you've got to get things done through people. So you're really building a team, you're educating and training that team, and that team has got to be apostles for your message on a global basis. When I was running Foot Locker, we had 150,000 employees worldwide, and we had 250,000 retirees.
Oh, shit.
So talking to the retirees whose pension is dependent on your success is different than talking to the 150,000 people running your business. So identifying, hiring, training top talent is a much higher priority. When you're smaller, you're rolling up your sleeves and sort of doing the work.
Well, is that how you end up with the same team of 5 guys that went with you to every single job you had starting
well,
in
1990? Well, if you can bring in people that you've trained and you know what they're capable of and they can hit the ground running, it does help. And you know, you join a new company, you parachute in from the outside and you don't know anybody, you got to learn their strengths and weaknesses. But I always believed in investing in training people, Matt. So that my line in the sand was, if I've trained you properly, 80% of the time, given the same set of facts, you and I will come to the same decision. 20% of the time, we won't.
Hmm.
Now, you could be right or I could be right, but as long as 80% of the time we're coming to the same conclusion, I'm comfortable letting you go. And the 20%, as long as it's not going to drive the car into a ditch or drive the company into a hole, I'll say, try your way. Maybe you're right. Now, if I'm right, no harm, no foul, we move on.
There's a note in the file.
Well, you only get so many of those before, you know, it's time to move on.
Yeah.
And then you say, what are you planning to do starting tomorrow with the rest of your life? Because this isn't working. So training people, developing people, and even when I got to be CEOs, I would hold training classes for the people one notch below my direct reports. Because I figured I was training my direct reports on a daily basis, but I wanted to get at the next layer.
Mm-hmm. And I would make sure there's not a telephone game situation happening.
That my message was being filtered.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
I would directly train one notch below my direct reports in order to make sure they were getting my message.
Would you then instruct them to train one notch below them? So you would skip train the whole way down the pyramid? That's very smart to ensure the consistent messaging.
Right.
That's very smart.
And then I would have every 2 weeks breakfast with Roger, where I would have a cross section of employees that I would engage with for an hour over breakfast. And, you know, could be somebody just joined the company, could be a
different every time.
And they could ask questions, and I would try to make sure they're hearing directly from me, you know, what the message was.
Mm-hmm. What about like companies where for a time it seemed like 1995 to the first few years at Ralph Lauren, 2005, that your main skill was really fixing companies that were in deep trouble.
Yeah, well, what you have to understand about your skill set is what are the tools in your toolbox? What am I good at? What am I not so good at? And like I could look at a page of numbers and identify the numbers that mattered and or the ones that were mistakes, going into a company, assessing what they're good at, what the problems are, what was needed urgently and what could be put on a back burner, I acquired skills to do that. So turning something around, dramatically enhancing performance, I got very good at identifying very quickly what were the key issues that had to be resolved.
What if the company has all this dead weight and you've been there months and it's time to cut, you know, hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of people?
That's a very difficult situation. And when I went to the forerunner of Foot Locker, which was Woolworth, the year I joined, they had just lost $900 million in a year.
Yeah, some of you guys out there might remember Woolworth, the five and dime. And that it's not in existence anymore. And you're welcome.
Yeah, well.
Big Raj sent Woolworth packing.
It peaked in the 1960s when it had 5,000 stores. When I got to it, it had 100 stores. So they had already, you know, closed the large number. But the 100 stores were losing $1 billion a year.
Oof.
And so quickly we had to decide if we could fix it or whether it was better to close
cut
it.
And my first ever, quote, job, if you could call it that, was at a Woolworths in White Plains, and I was stocking shelves. I don't know. It's probably like 15 or something. And you know what I got from that job? Life skill. I can walk into a store right now, and within 3 seconds, I could smell if there's dead rats in that store. I will never forget the smell of the presence of a dead rat somewhere in the store.
Well, there
and
you
whether
go.
It's a grocery store or fucking Marc Jacobs, I can walk in there and go because of that Woolworths.
There you go. Well, you've got a light skill out of it. That and speed lacing at Foot Locker.
Yeah, the speed lacing thing, I did. I won those competitions at Champs and Foot Locker for lacing shoes real fast.
Yeah, Matt was the speed champ.
They used to, when I started those jobs, they used to give me crap because I was a CEO's kid. But then it turned out I could actually sell shoes pretty good, and they laid off pretty fast. And then I would give them the rides home in the Lexus, and then it was great. Oh, you dropped me off at home in the Lexus? Oh, okay.
Well, you remember our deal. You wanted to buy a car, and I said I would match you dollar for dollar on your earnings.
I sold a lot of shoes.
And you went on hands and knees selling shoes on Sundays.
Saturday and Sundays.
And then when you got your paycheck and realized they took taxes away, what a rude welcome.
I didn't do the speed math.
But you saved up enough to buy that Mustang.
Yeah, I did. Well, it was the Subaru before that.
Oh, the Subaru,
which we then traded for the Mustang, yeah. What about, you know, you've run companies where there is a person's name on the door and a person at the top of the pyramid whose name is on the door. And you've run companies where it's more anonymous. No one really gives a shit who the executives are. What are some of the real core differences in working with those kinds of companies while not being the person whose name is on the door?
Well, look, the first thing I always do is I have tremendous respect and appreciation for a founder, somebody who had an idea, had a thought, built it into something, built up a name, just like you're doing, Matt. I mean, what you've done as an entrepreneur starting from scratch is so impressive to me. You know, maybe I've gone the other way and I've climbed the career ladders and I've moved up and all that stuff. But, you know, when I've gone to companies where the owner, founder, name on the door is, you know, one of the great assets. So I always start by saying, you know, how do I enhance this? How do I improve this? How do I preserve this? But underneath that, you got to run a business properly or that won't carry you forward. And so how you finance a business, how you manage it, how you market it, how you merchandise it, how you staff it, how you make money is agnostic between the two type of businesses.
But when you have that type of ego, have there been situations where you really had to stop the ego from doing something that could have been just catastrophic to the business for like an ego-related reason?
Sure. And that's always a tough discussion. And there's always, you know, there's a math point to be proven, but it's never about the math. Mm-hmm. It's about how do you balance either a branding moment that doesn't make economic sense, that may pay dividends long term, or owner founder wants to do something. And, you know, my point of view was I always tried to do as much as I could to accommodate those situations unless it was going to put us into a ditch.
Yeah.
In which case I threw myself in front of the bus and said, this isn't going to work for these reasons, and you know, you got to trust me on this. I've given on all these other occasions, but this time I think we got to say no.
Mm-hmm. I guess, yeah. There was a couple of really funny specific instances you've told me about that if you don't want to mention in a recorded medium,
yeah, I
think
we'll
leave understand.
That. We'll leave
I'm,
that between sorry, father and son.
Sorry, I'm sorry he didn't go there. If he did, it would have been really funny, but it's okay if he doesn't want to. Until today, he wouldn't even allow me to post pictures of him on social media if he visited.
Yeah, that's true.
Because, you know, we never know who you told where you were. Not that you were being dishonest or anything like that, but, you know, you got to juggle the balls, you know, and have...
Matt, I've always tried to keep a personal low profile. Now, sometimes my job doesn't always allow it, but it's never been about me. And, you know, your success and your career is about you. But I also remember the time at Woolworth on its way to being Foot Locker where we had security guards sitting in front of our house.
I remember that guy.
Following you to school.
Yeah. Oh, did he follow me to school?
He followed you to school.
Oh, I never knew that. You didn't tell me about that.
He wasn't supposed to follow you. Did you never? He just did that on his own.
Turns out he can't go near a school now. And
Or I got a letter.
No, I remember that guy. He sat in a Ford Probe in the driveway eating fucking McDonald's for couple of months probably, right?
Yeah, we needed security because, you know, we had threats.
And I don't remember him following me to school, though. How about that? He kept that on the sly this whole time.
Yeah, well, you keep that stuff in your head and you don't forget it. So
yeah.
I'm much better at running things, managing things, doing the right thing, but trying to keep a low profile as I can.
Yeah. Well, now you're retired.
So now I'm on the podcast.
Now you're retired. You can be anywhere.
I can be anything.
Now you
can
be anywhere.
Yeah.
And now, I mean, who cares? If you can't be work from home at this stage of the game, who can be, right? As I grew up, you know, starting from when I was little, our little house in New Jersey, and then slightly bigger house, slightly nicer cars, slightly bigger house, you know, and it, to me, your career seemed like a linear progression of bigger and bigger successes, and it pretty much was just this straight line ascent. Where was it not? Where's the big miss that I don't know about?
Well, interesting observation by you. We started, your mother and I started working at Saks together and met there and, got married there and started to have kids and she stopped working. Believe it or not, when we made the decision for her to stop working and stay with you guys, she was making more than I was.
Yeah, that comes up frequently.
And so it was a big decision who was going to stay home, me or mom. But
I think, honestly, if mom had stayed in the workforce, I think she could have been a very successful executive. I mean, she has the mind for it.
Yeah, she was a vice president at Saks Fifth Avenue when she left, but she made the investment in you and Alexis, and I think that was a good trade-off personally. But look, every job had its challenges. Every job had its stress points. Again, when I went to Woolworth initially, it had 32 companies in 17 countries, 30 of which lost money. And I,
you got to wonder how it gets there. I mean, is that, it's like looking at a 900-pound person and going, well, you didn't just wake up 900 pounds. You started at 3 and then 4 and then 5. And
it was in slow decline since the 60s, yeah. And I went there in 94. So you can imagine the speed with which that declined. And they had just fired the CEO and the CFO for cooking the books.
Whoa.
And I had to unscramble a company that was losing $900 million, about to go bankrupt. And of course, the day I started, they showed me the real books, which were different than the outside books. And that caused me to go to the board and saying, look, you know, you represented this to be this, and it's really that. I'm willing to try to work my way through it, but we're going to do it step by step. And we started
based on the real books.
Based on the real books, yeah. And the real situation.
It's like kitchen nightmares. It's like Gordon Ramsay coming in and being like, listen, that fucking sauce in there is from November. We need to understand that this is that sauce is
that
from November.
That doesn't work. And so we started to unravel it. But I would work from 7 in the morning till 10, 11 at night, go home exhausted, wake up at 1 in the morning after 2 hours of collapsed sleep. With so many ideas running through my head, I would get up and go back to work because I couldn't go back to sleep. That went on for 4 or 5 years until I fixed the business. And I was exhausted at the end of it, and it wasn't easy. And we had a business in Frankfurt, Germany, if you remember this. I went to Frankfurt every month for 3 days for 3 years to fix a business.
Was it Foot Locker, Germany or whatever
it was? Woolworth, Germany.
Oh, yeah.
It was $1.2 billion, losing $70 million. And I wanted to sell it, but I couldn't find a buyer until I fixed it.
Ja, fools was. No, you don't want to fool us?
That's where they burn the money.
Well, they had systems that told you the sales once a month, not once a day.
Oh, that seems
But
useful.
They had a system that showed everybody's birthday, and that was not important. So it was tough. It was tough.
But okay, but that's where you arrived somewhere and it was not as it was represented.
Right.
What about where you made a choice or a move that really just didn't work out?
You know what, Matt?
Or are you that lucky? Or
no,
good,
it's not that. I tried to learn something from everywhere I went. Now, you know, some places better than others, some places easier than others, but I always tried to learn something. And I can say, you know, with a straight face, when I left somewhere, I always left it better than I found it. And that was my hallmark of success.
Mm-hmm.
Is it better having had Roger here in some capacity over some period of time or not? And I always felt that way. I had more fun in some jobs than others. Some jobs where I was, you know, had some wind at my back. And if I did well, you know, it accelerated. Some jobs I had the wind in my face where even going from a D to a B level, I couldn't get to A, was still Herculean.
Mm-hmm.
And so I tried to learn from it. And, you know, the tough times were when I was traveling 150 nights a year all over the world. And you come home and you put your suitcase near the bed because it never goes away.
Yeah.
And by the time you've recovered, you're on your way to the next trip. And that was tough.
I never wanted to put on a suit, but I somehow ended up in that same position where I would work 12 hours a day and travel 150 to.
But
ended
you
up
have
in the same place.
You have passion. So when
passion,
yeah.
No,
you,
I like my job. It's okay.
You do it with more pleasure than if it's drudgery and you're just doing it to pay the bills.
Yeah, if you're just going into another fucking boardroom that happens to be in Shanghai, I mean that's horrible.
Yeah. Well, global travel in the beginning is fun because you're seeing the world, albeit through the eyes of a conference center,
right.
Or a, you know, but at some point it goes from being fun and interesting and different to, I can't believe I got to get another plane and fly 15 hours to Asia and be whacked out because it's 13-hour time difference.
Yeah,
work hard for 5 days, turn around and come back and, you know, go back into the office the next morning. I mean, those were tough times.
But is it? Obviously, with you know, Zoom and teleconferencing, and the landscape has really shifted in the last year. But ignoring just the last year, and maybe it's hard to do that. Your peak, let's call it the 90s and 2000s, where you're doing all that travel, but you're managing a lot of people, and you've got assistants, you know, that filter out a lot of the noise for you and manage your schedule. So your brain is going, but you're, you know where you got to be and when. And versus today, where we've got this thing in our pockets and it's expected that we are in contact 24/7 and expected response times for things are quicker. And it, do we have it better off now or do we have it better off then when we figured out, you know?
Yeah, interesting question. I did have well-trained help. And so my assistant would take at the time the mail or what became, you know, faxes or whatever. And she would sort it every day between urgent, you need to look at this today, you need to look at it this week, or she would put it in a travel folder that I would take on the plane, and I would take to the mailroom, and they would weigh it for me before I left. I would read it all through the plane ride through the night,
yeah,
make my comments.
The fucking bricks of paper. Wow. I mean, the bricks of paper.
And then when I would land,
he would bring home these bricks, 4 or 5 inches thick, and it's just a brick of numbers. There's
right.
nothing. It's just numbered page, numbered. What do you even do with this? What are you even looking
so,
for?
But he sees the music.
I get
it,
off
know?
The plane and I take the package that was pre, you know, weighed and stamped, and I stuck it in the envelope back to her. But I also would come home at night after a long day, and I would have bricks of information prepping for the next day.
It was just
because
so much homework.
What you spent a week on and you hand it to Zach and he spent 10 hours on and he hands it to me and I can spend an hour on it, mm-hmm. it better be good, it better be right, it better be thoughtful, and I would read it at night on my lap watching
yeah.
TV.
No,
so I would
I
be
remember.
Prepared. But
yeah.
I actually, the old days gave me some insulation from this insanity where somebody sends you an email at 11 and at 3 a.m. people are responding, and mm-hmm. if you wake up and you're the last to respond, you feel like you're slow.
Yeah,
that has for me gone
that's
too far.
That's the new being getting to work after your boss, right? Is being the last person on the chain to respond to that
dude,
email.
Being on the West Coast when the job I used to have, everyone's
yeah.
based on the East Coast, always felt up, I always woke up feeling like I was on the back foot
yeah.
every day.
Why do you think I started getting up at 5:30?
Yeah.
My work day goes from 6 a.m. to 3 p.m. I work East Coast hours on the West Coast because otherwise I'm behind by the time I wake up.
I understand it, but I have gone through decades of transformation there. You know, when I first started at Saks Fifth Avenue in 75, came out of school, executive trainee, making $119 a week, by the way.
Zach, what's that for inflation? That's one of those things that doesn't sound like much, but I bet you that's like fucking 60 G's a year now or something.
I doubt it.
No,
it would have to be a lot.
What year?
119 in bucks in 1975.
119 bucks a week.
Yeah.
But my new CEO started to come in at 7 a.m.
It's not much. $590. That is not a lot. You're right.
That's right.
Yeah, not a lot.
Well, I guess your loan calculator says I can't even get a loan on that.
Yeah, they won't give you. They won't give 600 you
600 a week. So you're
that.
Making what $30,000 a year?
Yeah,
into,
it's not
in,
much
today's money.
Yeah, not much.
Yeah. But I came in earlier than him. I've told you this, where he came in at 7.
Yeah, no, tell me, you've told me, but tell them, because I've used this before.
Okay, so I'm a trainee, I'm just out of college, I'm making nothing, I'm at Saks Fifth Avenue, I'm sitting in a bullpen of glass cubicles, and we get a new CEO within the first month of my arrival, and I notice that he comes in and goes to his office at 7 a.m. So I started coming in at 6:30. So I would be at my desk, having commuted from New Jersey at 6:30, and he would pass my little cubicle, see me sitting there, and he would walk to his office. So the first week, he walked by me. Second week, he nods. Third week, he says, good morning. By the fourth week, he says, who are you? And what are you doing here?
Yeah.
Come see me on Saturday, because he works Saturdays. So I go in to see him on Saturday, and he says, you know, I see you more than I see my vice presidents. You know, who are you? Tell me about yourself. And, you know, I'm new to Saks. What do you think I should do?
Do some math. Can you do these interest rates for me?
And so he said, tell me 3 things you think I should be working on. Now, I was right out of school.
The CEO said, tell me 3 things that you think he should be working on? Why did he even say that?
Was this a test he was giving you, seeing that you seemed to be motivated but making sure you were for real? Like,
it was his way of getting to know me.
Okay.
Because he was curious about who is this guy who beats me to work every day. I'm sure his ego was wrapped up in I'm the first guy to work every day. And now a trainee is sitting there every morning. Wait, he doesn't know if I get in there at 4 or 5. All he knows is I'm there before him. And he wanted to see how I thought. And I told him, well, I think, you know, the men's department isn't well run, and I think the HR department. He says, you know, I like you. I'm going to make you a buyer, which meant I stepped over being an assistant buyer. I stepped over being a department manager. I jumped from being there a couple months, 3 or 4 years ahead, based on this conversation with the guy. He said, I'm going to have you go see the senior VP next week, and he has a job for you. Well, he must have told the senior VP, who hated the idea, felt totally put out. And the guy said, well, I have 4 buying openings. I've been told to make you a buyer. Very nice of him to say it that way. There's the men's sweaters. I said, well, that's kind of interesting.
For those who have no idea what this is, you would go to factories and design houses and literally buy the items that go on the shelves in a department store that sells many different brands.
Or see fashion in Europe and go to Asia and have it made and, you know, assort the sweater department of Saks Fifth Avenue. He said, no, that I have somebody in mind for that. Men's neckwear, ties at the time. Oh, that could be interesting. I got somebody in mind. I'm going to make you the underwear, pajama, and sock buyer. I said, underwear, pajama, and sock? I don't want to do that. He said, what are you, crazy? You're going to be a buyer after being here for 6 minutes? So I said, all right, well, I'll do it, but I don't need an assistant. I can do it myself. Well, first year I had a 40% increase, and they made me the shoe buyer.
Yeah.
And the guy said, don't expect you're going to have a 40% increase. Shoes are really hard. And by the way, today's Thursday. You're now the shoe buyer. Friday, you have to go to Italy on a buying trip. I don't know anything about shoes. I basically wore sneakers most of my life. Now I'm the shoe buyer. And what happened was, because it was a business that had your name attached to results, your results spoke for themselves.
You're the buyer, so it's, here's your numbers.
You're up 30, you're down 30. Yeah, So it wasn't about how you part your hair or do they like you or not like you. The results spoke for themselves, and that's all I wanted. So if I did well, you had to promote
me. What was wrong with the shoe department?
It was sleepy and dusty and out of fashion, and I had a huge increase in shoes, which they couldn't believe.
Didn't you, as a buyer or a young executive, introduce a brand into America for the first time?
Yeah, so you're remembering the story that my first buying trip to Europe after a day on the job, I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to go find fashion in Europe, blah, blah, blah. And I saw everybody wearing these rubber-soled, you know, wingtip in sort of tan leather. Everywhere I went, I said, okay, that must be a trend. And I bought a whole bunch of shoes, and they came in 6 months later.
And the trend
was
dead.
And I can't sleep at night. I go to the stock room. I open the boxes. I put them away. I put the shoes out. And it was dead on arrival. Nothing sold. And I was so despondent. I marked them down, and they sold out. So what did that tell me?
They were overpriced?
The price was wrong.
Right.
Otherwise, the fashion, the fit, the quality was right.
Okay.
About the same time, these two guys walk in to see me from Canada, from Roots, and they were trying to sell me negative heel shoes, where the heel is lower than the front. They were supposed to be good for your back at the time.
These are the fucking Kramer shoes from Seinfeld.
Right.
It's like the jumping shoes, right?
Right. And I said, well, I don't think we can sell that. But if you can make these shoes for this price.
The wingtips.
Yeah. Maybe we can have a business.
Mm-hmm.
They went back. They made the shoes. It was a blowout success. And that started the Roots business, which became huge in Canada. You saw John Candy wear the jacket at the Olympics.
Yeah.
So I really helped get them started. And that success then got me elevated to be the clothing buyer, and I was buying suits and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
So, that's interesting.
Yeah. The what else did I write down here? Oh, yeah. Are we post-peak retail? Is retail, you know, you've built and had big stores, you know, multi-million dollar Ralph Lauren stores and all these crazy, you know, anchor stores. They do $20 million in the first week in Tokyo or whatever the fuck, but like, Is retail dead?
Well, not if you ask Amazon.
Well, is in-person retail dead?
I think it's going to be a hybrid. I think people like to go out and shop. I think this country got overstored. If you look at the amount of retail square footage in this country versus any other developed country in the world, we're 7x.
Whoa.
So
wait, repeat that. Say that again.
The amount of square footage per capita in the U.S. is 7x any other developed.
And that includes residential and commercial?
No. retail space?
Oh, we have 7 times as much retail space per individual as any other developed nation.
So that's fucking what you see contracting now.
Yeah.
That overbuilt, the over malls, retail is all contracting.
To where it will find a little
more
balance.
Where it will find its level.
Mm-hmm.
That, in complement with online shopping, I believe is the future.
Mm. So did, so you think those big splashy anchor stores will stay, but the smaller regional stores may not?
I think where there were developments that were speculative and they built them with a belief customers would drive an hour or two to get there are in real trouble.
Yeah.
Many of them are being plowed under now. Some of them have been converted to medical centers or other uses.
Well, we're looking at the, we're considering department stores for storing cars in.
Right, because the footprint is
a tall ceiling, a big footprint, and it's sitting there.
And sales per square foot kept dropping and dropping and dropping, so people would cut the staff.
Mm-hmm.
The service got worse. The assortments got thinner because people would put less inventory. So now you go into this big monstrous store, doesn't have enough inventory, doesn't have enough help, and a spiral keeps going down.
Yeah, yeah. You were just talking about the crazy hours and, all this travel. After 50 years, all the money that you and we will ever need and all the success that anyone will ever need, was the work-life balance worth it? Or if you didn't do, if you were advising someone else, maybe your son or someone like him, if working that hard for that many years to end up where you've now ended up, if that is a worthwhile pursuit, or if dialing it back a little bit for your sanity could have been okay too.
Matt, it's the essential question of all this work. I was very competitive. I like to win. Never going to end up the richest person when you're fundamentally an employee, even as a CEO. Owners make more than employees. But I was competitive and I like to win. And I had great stamina at that stage of my life. And I had an amazing wife, and I have an amazing wife in Vivian, who I felt the kids were in good hands. But then there's a but. I never took more than a 1 week vacation until very late in my life, which was a mistake. I could have taken two. Nothing bad would have happened. I worked 6 days a week the first 25 years of my life. I'm not sure I needed to do that, but I was driven to do it. I certainly tried to put the family, in a position of comfort, but, there are trade-offs. And it's not just you're physically traveling. Sometimes when you get home, you're too tired to engage in the normalcy of the family life or life with your friends. So
the way I saw it was, and maybe this isn't the right term, but you attempted to retire a couple of times,
and
you were not successful at it.
You
got bored.
I totally accept that because I did try a couple times, and I tried to change the paradigm a couple times, and my mind was very active. I still had ideas, and I got sucked back in. Now maybe the answer to your question is, I could have run at 100 miles an hour and then stayed retired.
Yeah.
And maybe that's would a better solution.
Could have gone yacht life at 45. That could have worked, too.
I could have done any of those.
Yeah.
I didn't. Regrets. I try to look forward and not look back. So I try now, even though I'm much older.
But would your advice now be to take that 2 week vacation?
Yes.
It'll be all right?
I would say you got to be passionate about what you do. You got to give it your best, because my worst fear, and I've told you this, is waking up later in life and saying, I wasn't successful because I didn't try hard enough. If I don't succeed, let it be because I don't have the ability or the skill. Don't let it be because I didn't try hard enough. And even when I played sports, there was a point at which, no matter how much I practiced, I couldn't get good enough to get to the next level. And I had to say, okay, I've tried my best. It's time to move on. But in work, I didn't want to wake up and say, if I had just tried harder. Now, that drove me. But the trade-off is, could I have taken a second week? Of course I could have.
Yeah.
Could I have taken the full weekend off? Of course I could have. But now I'm looking at it through the lens of 68 years old versus 38 or 48.
Well, I think that's why I'm trying to not ignore it now at 40. I'm trying to determine what level of success, what level of financial reward, you know, and what level of driving myself crazy with work, where does it happen where I, because I watched you.
Well,
I don't want to.
No, I'm jealous. I think you do it better than I did it.
Well, because I had an example to watch. You didn't have an example to watch.
I didn't.
And so, or maybe you had an example. I mean, I don't even know what the hell it was like waking up and watching Grandpa go to work every day. I mean, that must have been borderline scary.
Yeah, but you've from afar, I'm watching from afar, I think you've found a better work-life balance. And I think you take great joy and pleasure out of the things you do outside of work.
Sure.
Where in my case, I was always distracted. So I don't look back. I don't. I try to, if I learn something, I try to apply it going forward. But I think the work-life balance that you're trying to achieve is a better work-life balance than I had.
Okay. Well, I mean, I'm pretty happy with my life, so I'll take it. I will. And retired Roger's good. Retired Roger's enjoying his life. Last one of mine before we get to some from the fans. All these jobs, you know, we just talked about some of the downsides, the struggles, the stuff that is a little less glamorous outside the headlines and the paychecks. Let's end that on a. What is the best job perk? Aside from a nice check and, you know, shares, what is the coolest job perk that you have gotten from one of these jobs?
I tell you that I got the biggest juice out of the affirmation from the people that said, I feel safe with you on the wall. This is the Jack Nicholson line. And I used to get cards and letters or people coming up to me and saying, thank you. This bonus check has been changed my life. I can take care of my parents or I can send my kids to school. And I feel safe under your leadership. That affirmation was as gratifying to me as stock options or, you know, any of the other supposed perks of the job. But what I had to accept is I wanted to be in charge. I wanted the final shot. I wanted the decision. I wanted to be able to handle the pressure. But when people said to me later, you changed my life, hopefully for the better, that to me was all the gratification I needed.
I was hoping for some material bullshit, but okay, we'll go with that.
That's a much, much better answer.
Yeah, that's like the Rock answer. I'm just here for the fans. It's really just about the fans. Well, that's my prep. That's what I have.
But we have never received more questions in a shorter amount of time than
ever?
This show. Within 15 minutes, I said, please stop asking questions.
Really?
We had four pages.
Oh, my God. All right.
So feel free to, you know, answer as many or as few as you want. But I'm just telling you, like, people, I filtered them. I think these are pretty good.
Okay.
And thank you to the fans for asking pretty good, appropriate questions. If you had a general car question or a watch question or something, I skipped it. For obvious reasons.
Well, I'm going to talk about cars because Matt and I have had some fun car experiences, and I would probably relate to our trip to the Baja.
Yeah.
When Matt and I went there because Alexis and Matt's vacation didn't line up, and I said, all right, I'll go with Matt somewhere, and Vivian went with Alexis, and I thought Matt was going to say, let's go play golf in Hilton Head, and he said, well, I've entered us in the Baja 500.
We did the wide open Baja. The wide open Baja, full experience.
And we got in this car.
BCS one class.
The seats are welded to the frame. There's no give. We have air hoses. We have helmets. We have neck braces. We have back braces. And he's a little nervous. And he's the youngest guy in the race. And I'm the oldest guy in the race. And he says, you drive first. And we start driving. And we're bouncing along. And my kidneys, within 30 minutes, say, I got to go to the bathroom. There's no absorption in this car. And you know, after a while, I'm getting a little comfortable. I think I'm Steve McQueen in Bullet, and The second day,
in the Baja boot.
Yeah.
A car in front of us goes over a hill, flips over, ends up in a ditch.
Oh, yeah.
A
guy rolled it, didn't he?
Guy's bleeding. Yeah. One guy has a concussion. Matt and I pull over. We've got to call the helicopter to get these people out of here.
I forgot about that. And, yeah. And I don't want to get out.
I don't want to get in the car again. And so I'm like, I've gone from Steve McQueen to Walter Mitty. And that's going faster and faster every day, doing more of the driving. This is the greatest day of my life as we're flying along.
Launching the buggy.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm getting out of the car.
We were the only group in the part of the wide open class to not really break our shit, too. Right. We didn't break our car, and everyone else broke their shit.
But you remember when the car started smoking and they had to cut a hole in the in the hood?
Yeah, I guess we got, I don't know what happened, but the engine started to overheat. And it was a Subaru motor in these things, and so they were water-cooled. And so it had the radiator up front, and they just hacksawed a hole right in the bodywork.
They
right
threw it aside, and they said, keep going, you'll be fine.
Good. And they were right.
They run a good outfit, they do.
But having said that, you know, he's talking about bitching out and everything. Meanwhile, that was directly led to my first back surgery.
So I'm getting beat to hell, and every night we pull into a place, and I'm passing out on the bed, and Matt's going out to party with the paratroopers and sniper rifle guys who were in this trip. I said, wake me in the morning. I'm covered in dust.
Everybody there was such a tough guy.
and a week after we get back, Matt needs back surgery.
Yeah,
so
my God, something hurts.
He took it hard, but yeah. Amongst our trips, that was one of the more fun things and memorable things to do.
That's a good one. Ben says, as someone very experienced running large organizations, can you talk about some of your top leadership skills and tactics, aside math, and how you worked on those skills? We already talked about your knowing the questions ahead coming back, and we already talked about keeping a solid team around you. Anything else you want to add to that?
I think one of the things I would say from a career point of view is always be as prepared as you can be. If you go into an interview or if you go into a situation, do your homework. Do as much research, a lot easier now than it used to be. Know as much about people as you could know and make sure you're as prepared. Don't ever walk into a meeting thinking you're just going to wing it because you always miss something. So I would add that. And the other fourth point after people and math would be stamina. You need a lot of mental and physical stamina to succeed in these kind of jobs.
Mm-hmm. I think we covered Joe's there. What are your opinions on the MBA? Is it necessary?
My simple answer is no. I went to an undergraduate business school, so I had 4 years of...
Didn't you graduate in three?
I did, but it's
Why
a four-year school.
That? Why did you get out of college early in 3 years? That seems like something not most people don't do.
I missed my senior year, which I should have had.
Yeah, why?
I was so determined to see how good I was, and I thought college was so theoretical. And I looked at the teachers, and I said, you've never done this in the real world. You're all book smart, but... And I said, I want to see if I'm any good.
How interesting, considering I went to that school fucking 30 years later.
Well, I went to summer school every night of, I had a job during the day, and then I went at night from 6 to 8 and from 7 to 9 on Thursday, Tuesday.
Were you playing a sport at the same time?
Was I what?
Playing a sport at the same time?
I played soccer and basketball the first couple of years, and then I stopped because I wanted to get out early and I needed to double up on my classes. So
Your basketball team got pretty far, though, right? Weren't you on a very successful basketball team?
Well, when I was a freshman, you know, we had a freshman team. They were number one in the country most of the year and ended up number three. But I think you can get a high-quality education, and you don't need an MBA to succeed.
This one may or may not be in Dad's wheelhouse, but how do you see privacy as a commodity in this age? Is it kind of uncompromising to just have a phone? You insulate yourself. I mean, you are very privacy-oriented. So
yeah, I try to keep my privacy, my thoughts, my life private as best I can. I think what's great about technology is access to information, and I think you can use it for that without having to put yourself out there. You live with your life out there, Matt, so you've come to a different answer.
I figured out how to make it work okay, though.
Because I've seen you stressed out because your phone never stops and your emails never stop.
Yeah, I figured out. You know, Hannah's helped me figure out when to turn it off and things like that.
Yeah, I saw that at dinner the other night when she said, turn the phone off.
I was talking to her brother who's sick. Can't win with your wife. Either talk to the brother too much, talk to the brother not enough, or now is the wrong time
to talk. I understand. But my personal opinion is use the best parts of technology and keep yourself more private.
This is an interesting question, and the background of it, Adrian, how much of your success would you attribute to sacrificing work-life balance and being willing to move locations and or traveling? You traveled a lot, but we also moved from New Jersey to Atlanta and then from Atlanta back to New York for jobs.
Yeah. Well, early in my career, I was willing to do what I had to do in terms of location changes or work. My wife was very supportive,
But didn't you also say no to a couple pretty good jobs because of where we would have had to move?
A ton of them, because there were...
What was the biggest job you turned down? Disney?
Well, Disney, Harrods in London.
Harrods.
The Gap in San Francisco, on and on and on. And, you know, once we got done with the turnaround at Woolworth, every company that needed a turnaround would call me.
Yeah.
And my answer was, you know, I've done that once. It was a near-death experience. Don't want to do it again. Right. Yes, I have the skills, but I don't want to do it. And so I'd
like to manage a short egomaniac for 15 years instead. Let me just do that. That'll be fun. Ben says, it was great to meet you at the Aston Martin party at Pebble Beach. We may be back there. Save us a space, Ben. Ed says, Roger, what was the most valuable piece of advice given to you in your career? Also, any general tips for soon-to-be graduated business management student?
I would say,
before your boss. That was the story that was worthwhile.
Well, for sure, outwork the competition is one of them. But I think you got to start with have a passion for what you do. You know, love the business, the industry, your career.
Would you say that was the best piece of advice given to you? Or do you have
No, that's my best advice to anybody who's starting now.
Yeah.
Make sure you can be if you spend 30, 40, 50 years in an industry, hopefully it's something you love.
Zach, scroll down. I want to sort by interesting. It's nothing personal, anybody. Timothy, how would someone stand out with a bachelor's degree in apparel design, wants to work in high fashion or outdoor? How does a designer fashionista stand out? Did you ever work on that side of the business, the design side?
Yeah, I mean, look, talent is in short supply. So if your friend is talented or you're talented and you're in the creative side of any business, whether it's car design or whether it's apparel and fashion, people are always looking for talent. It's much harder to find design talent than business talent. And so I would always try to start with the top companies, because your ability to express yourself in a top company is better than a struggling company, where there's an urgency about survival and there's not a chance to take risk. Better companies can take risks, and therefore I'd rather start there when I'm looking for work.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever been in a situation as an executive where a brand is doing some really like avant-garde, like weird Yeezy thing, and you're like, I don't know what you guys are even doing, but okay.
Well, in the 70s and 80s, Japanese designers started to come on the scene, and their design aesthetic was so different than Europe or the United States, it was shocking.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that it took a while to get adjusted to their design aesthetic and for it to become considered more mainstream.
Yeah. Yeah, Zach's got the foam run. I don't understand. Someone is going to have to explain to me why anyone spends a dime on that thing. I just don't get it.
But wow, that's kind of cool.
If you bought that as a shoe buyer, I mean, it's like
I would have called the Roots guys to redesign it.
Can we knock this thing off 20%?
Like, I don't think shoes are your thing, but if you make life jackets, I will sell your life jackets.
Tyler says, "What was? We'll do Hayden's after Tyler's. What was your first job? Did you always see yourself climbing ranks in the fashion world, or what sucked you in? You want to talk about Grandpa's factory?"
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting career I've ended up with, because I probably have less interest in pure fashion than most.
No shit. I've seen what you're wearing. Like you're going dressed like you're going fly fishing this afternoon.
I'm ready. I'm assuming this is the work life balance, man. Yeah. You said if we work for an hour, we could have fun this afternoon.
Very good.
But I would say the, you know, the reality of trying to deal with fashion as a consequence of my business experience came out of my father, Matt's grandfather, who owned a small robe company. And when I was a teenager, I worked in that in summers in the shipping department, in the cutting room, on the cutting room tables, and, you know, in the fabric buying departments. And I was going to go into the family business.
However, which others did.
My older brothers, two older brothers and three cousins were already in it. There was a lot of, you know, conversation about whether Roger's coming in. I was the youngest son. And working there in the summers, I saw a lot of the family drama play out. And, you know, when I was coming out of school, my father said, why don't you go into retail for a couple of years and see if you like it and never look back.
You're like, yes, and out. Hayden says, how do you feel about Wall Street pressuring executives into meeting EPS numbers, sometimes making them use unsound accounting? I don't know what an EPS number is, but I'm sure
earnings
you do.
Per share.
Oh, sorry. Okay.
The answer is there is a lot of pressure. You do get scrutinized for how well you perform against Wall Street expectations. So people do feel pressure, but your personal integrity is what prevents you from making unsound decisions. If you don't have integrity, believe me, the auditors aren't going to stop it and the board of directors aren't going to stop it. Dishonest executives create dishonest experiences. So I did have pressure. I never felt the need to do anything in the gray.
I always thought your ethics were, and what you told me about ethics really, really did stick to me. And I've always kind of been worried that one day I was going to find out you were full of shit, but I'm glad I haven't.
Hey, Matt, thank
all right.
you.
I was worried, you know, you was like, nope. Man, I just don't, please don't let me be wrong about his fucking ethics. Please, please.
Try to do the right thing.
Yeah, yeah. We don't have to have Dad talk about me. Mm-hmm. I can't sit through that. I'm sorry. Jake says, what was your first and current car?
Well, my first car was a hand-me-down Volkswagen Beetle that we bought in Stuttgart, my two older brothers and I. I was 14, they were 16 and 21.
All three brothers over 6 feet tall.
We drove a Volkswagen Beetle around Europe for 2 months and then shipped it back to the United States. And then it started with my older brother, then my middle brother, and then I got as a hand down. And then very soon after that, I ended up with a 1971 orange GTO.
Now, I believe it was a 72.
Oh, 72. Thank you. Yes.
And the reason I know that is because I have been looking for one for years. And as it turns out,
there weren't many.
There were very few. The GTO was discontinued after the 71 model line. You know, its GTO started as an option package for the Le Mans, then became its own model. And then between 72 and 74, it went back to an option package as the Le Mans. So it looks like a GTO, yeah. But it's a Le Mans GTO. They have a different hood. They have a different nose. And the difference between a 71 and a 72 is that you fucking never see a 72. They don't exist.
Well, I had one, and it's the love of my life. Zach's showing me a picture.
Ever,
that's
it. It's the 72. See, the way to tell the difference with a 72, it has the big nostrils down by the nose.
Yes.
Whereas the 69 to 71 has the small nostrils in the middle.
So I had the big nostrils down near the nose.
What color was yours?
Mine was like a burnt orange.
Like on the bottom, second row on the right, maybe?
Sort of. It's hard to tell that.
I mean, it was the orange Pontiac color, right? Everyone knows about the orange Pontiac color. Yeah, that's it.
That's it, Zach.
That's it.
You found
that's the orange Pontiac color. I mean, it's a cool car, but they don't exist anymore. They made in the three digits of these in 72.
Well, that car, when I dream, I still have dreams of that.
Well, after this show, I bet you.
Let's go find one.
We won't have to. After this show, they will come to us.
Okay, I'm ready.
We talk about something on this show, Zach and I talked about a Volkswagen we casually might theoretically eventually someday want to buy. A dozen of them in my inbox.
All right.
By
well,
the next
if somebody's
day.
Got one, let me know.
If you got a 72 GTO automatic, it's got to be a real GTO coupe orange, let me know. Could be in the cards.
I just love that you're like, can't find one. And Roger's like, it's my only dream. they're almost impossible to find. He's like, I dream about it all the time.
It's the only car I dream of.
I got a Smarty Bird for my wife.
I now have a Porsche Cayenne Turbo and a Aston Martin Vanquish.
So the Cayenne, he doesn't like to order shit, which with in Porsche world is that's a problem if you don't like to order stuff, because you're left with what's on the lot, which is what people ordered and then didn't want when it arrived. He likes to show up on the lot and point at something and go, that one.
I'm into instant gratification.
That's how you ended up with the weirdest spec Cayenne Turbo in history.
It's unique.
It's fucking weird.
But that's why you can't find my GTO.
What's weird about the Cayenne?
It's black over espresso leather. With the
cool.
factory aero kit and factory aero sport design wheels. It then has the extended burlwood leather with contrast, burlwood dash with contrast
sounds
stitching.
Sounds nice, Zach, right?
It's really strange.
It's going to be a collector's item.
I like the espresso
item.
Leather. I don't know.
It's really strange. I think it's strange, but whatever.
But you're colorblind.
I could see that shit. I could see the color of poo.
Point Farrah's.
Point Young Farrah. Andy says, how would Roger recommend someone a rung below the C-suite at a small PE-backed venture address the C-suite about their missteps and failings? How would a mid-level manager tell a top-level executive about bad things that are going on?
Well, if it's bad things going on in the company, that's one answer. If it's mistakes they made and
it
they want to complain.
It says their missteps and failings.
I think, you know, your question obviously points to the obvious, which some C-suite people don't like to be told when they're wrong. I think if you build your case that's thoughtful and why, given the choices, this one is perhaps wrong and there are some other ways to go, what you want to do is not just point out what's wrong, but point out ways to solve it.
An alternative? Yeah.
That is a helpful conversation. If it just comes across as a criticism, as a critique, people don't like that too much.
No, probably not.
So when people would come to me with a problem or a crisis, and I would say, so tell me how you think about this. Tell me what the choices were. Tell me how you got to this one. And you know, that's the basis of a conversation. If you just want to push a problem onto my desk, that's not very helpful.
Yeah. We'll come back to some of these. Keep going down. Is that it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. We'll go, then we will do these. What is the most stressful job you've had, and how did you manage the stress? Not well, I can say from home.
Well, I think we talked about it a little earlier. This
the
blood and guts turnaround was quite difficult. And when you're unwinding a broken business and undoing fraudulent balance sheets, and you're trying to do it in the best possible way, it's not easy to communicate it, and it's not easy to be the decision maker that has to make hard decisions. And it's, you know, that expression, as lonely at the top, is true. You're left with a lot of tough decisions. And
did any of those people like go to jail or anything like that? Or was there anything criminal about what they did, or was it just
well, they were fined by the SEC,
they okay.
and they were, you know, there was some, you know, bad stuff that went on. But once I took over, our job was to fix it.
It was move forward, yeah. Buzziness says, working in an LBO group, the articles about the merger, I imagine we're talking about Tiffany and LVMH, seemed pretty interesting. Any stories about dealing with investment bankers? They can be pretty clueless.
You know, investment banking is a very interesting profession because they get paid a percentage of the deal price.
No matter what.
Where the lawyers and the accountants get paid by the hour. So their goal often is to drive the price as high as possible. As an acquirer, that's not a good thing.
Yeah.
As a seller, it is a pretty good thing.
So you were the seller in this case, so
we
it actually worked in your benefit.
So their desire to help a transaction occur was a positive. But in the end, you know, they're very good ones, they're very honorable ones, and they're ones I probably wouldn't do business with again. And I think that's the range of any. Mm-hmm. But the amount of money they made on this transaction relative to the work they did was disproportionate.
Joe says, what is the best simple advice you could give to a recent college grad ignorant to the world? That's a pretty big, tough question. But
well, I would combine a couple answers into be passionate about what you want to do. Invest in yourself. Read, learn, study. Don't necessarily wait for the company that employs you to do all your education. I always believed you owed it to yourself to learn at least 50%, and I owed you 50% in education. But if you only expect the company you're working for to teach you, you're going to shortchange your opportunities.
Mm. And finish it out with, how impressed are you that I'm sponsored by Tradecraft Farms? That's the weed company.
I understand. Well, I am very proud of you on so many levels. That may not be the highest one.
Oh, that's not what you're telling everybody about? No. What's more interesting is how I met the guys from Tradecraft Farms, because usually when I'm at a car show or something, people approach me and say, hey, you're Matt, or you're the guy from the smoking tire, or whatever. Now it was, are you Roger's son? That's how I met them. And one of those guys used to make shoes and sell them to one of your companies. And so he actually knew you. And that's how I got into the Tradecraft Farms. We're going to go on a little. I'm going to take my parents on Monday to a grow up. We're going to take them to Tradecraft Farms so they can actually see it.
And we're excited.
They have requested this
shit. I want to say this.
I think it's so interesting. It's going to be really funny. It's an amazing turn. It's very funny. So, well, how was that? Was that okay?
That was great, Matt. Thanks for having me.
This is my job now.
Why did we wait so long? I was nervous.
Because you never wanted to tell anybody that you were in California. That was why.
All right, I'm retired now.
Now you're retired. It doesn't matter. Now we can have a weekly business advice show.
Okay.
If you want. Give you something to do. We'll build a studio at the house.
Cool.
You could remote it in.
Cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's something to work on.
Yeah.
Thanks for having
people
me.
People have been asking for you to come do this for years.
Well, Zach, I'm proud of you too, because I've now known you for 10 years, and you guys have made something of yourself. So I'm very proud of both of you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well done.
Thanks, Dad.
Hats off.
Thank you. I avoided, there's other questions that people were like, tell us about Matt. And I was like, I don't want to hear about myself on this show. Sorry.
Well, you but know that we're proud of you.
I do. I have no doubts.
We get
that
great
you're proud
joy out of your success and your passion in life.
When you first came out to LA to hang out with me, and I got stopped on the street by a fan, and it like blew your fucking mind. We've turned.
The tables have turned.
We're in Hollywood, and you have a fan. This is
my
crazy
son Matt, and now this is my father Roger.
Yeah.
And when we got recognized in South Africa, by one of your fans, that was shocking.
Yeah. Getting recognized on the other side of the world is crazy.
That was shocking, but I'm proud. And I have people who work for me who figure out the connection. Matt's your son?
Yeah.
I have a 14-year-old boy. You think Matt would, like, communicate with him?
Probably.
I go up two levels in esteem.
If it helps you get that extra bit of work out of that guy, for sure.
Well, I appreciate it.
Well, that's our show, folks.
Thank you for having me.
That's my dad. Here he is. If you're a shareholder, sorry, he was here. No more shares. That's our show. Zach, what do we have in the can for next week? Is anything on the schedule right now?
No.
Cruise show?
Cruise show when I'm back. I'm out of town for a couple days.
Oh, Thursday, right?
Yeah.
Q&A cruise show on Thursday. All right. Live people, thank you for joining us live on a Saturday morning, and thank you for submitting your questions. We appreciate that. And we're going to go to like the farmer's market or something. Go do something.
Ooh. Good idea.
Greg right. from Sotheby's is calling in on
Friday.
Oh,
yeah. That's Greg from Sotheby's Auctions. We're going to be talking about in-person auctions are back. They're bringing big dollars. Everyone's throwing out records. Barrett Jackson and RM, and they've all thrown out record numbers on these auctions. So we're going to be talking about car auction values next week. See you guys later. Bye.